5. Over green countryside, the fields, the meadows, the open world of North American forests with occasional clusters of buildings, domains at odd, unexpected locations, Joseph Adams flew by Flapple from his own domain on the Pacific where he was Dominus to the agency in New York City where he was one Yance man among many. His workday, the longed-for and at last achieved Monday, had come. Beside him on the seat lay a leather briefcase initialed JWA in gold, which contained his handwritten speech. Behind him, crowded together in the rear seat, four leadys from his personal entourage. Meanwhile, by vidphone, he discussed biz with his associate from the agency, Vern Lindblom. Vern, not an idea man, not a user of words, but an artist in the visual sense, was in a better position than Joseph Adams to know exactly what their superior, Ernest Eisenblut, in Moscow had in mind scene-wise, was up to at the studio.
"It's San Francisco next," Lindblom said. "I'm building it now."
"What scale?" Adams asked.
"No scale."
"Life size?" Adams was incredulous. "Brose has okayed it? This isn't another of Eisenblut's hare-brained storms of creative..."
"Just a segment. Knob Hill and overlooking the bay. Should take about a month to construct. There's no rush. Hell, they just ran that Detroit sequence last night."
Lindblom sounded relaxed, and as a master craftsman, he could afford to be. Idea men were 1/4 post-credit dozen, but the actual fabricators? They were a closed guild which even Brose, with all his agents, couldn't crack. They were like the red-stained glass makers of France in the 13th century. If they perished, their skills perished with them. "Want to hear my new speech?"
"God, no," Lindblom said genially.
"It's hand-done." Adams spoke with humility. "I kicked out that gadget. It was getting me into a rut."
"Listen," Lindblom said, all of a sudden serious. "I heard a rumor. You're going to be pulled off speeches and put onto a special project. Don't ask me what. My source didn't know." He added, "A footman told me."
"Hmm." He tried to look calm, to show poise, but inside he felt queasy. Undoubtedly, since it took priority over his regular job, this emanated from Brose's bureau. And there was something about Brose and his special projects that he did not like. Although just what?
"It's something you might enjoy," Lindblom said. "Has to do with archaeology."
Adams grinned. "I get it. Soviet missiles are going to destruct Carthage.
And you're going to program Hector and Priam and all those fellas. Get out your Sophocles, your pony or crib sheet or whatever."
"My friends," Adams intoned in solemn parody, "I have grave news for you, but we shall overcome. The new Soviet ICBM Hatchet Girl A3 missile with a sea warhead has strewn radioactive common table salt over an area surrounding Carthage 50 square miles wide, but this only goes to show..." He paused. What did Carthage produce, autofact-wise? Vases? Anyhow, that was Lindblom's job. The display of postcards scanned by the multifax lens system of the TV cameras at Eisenblut's mammoth, intricate, in fact endlessly prop-filled studios in Moscow. "This, my good people and friends, is all that remains. But I am informed by General Holt that our own strike, utilizing our newly developed offensive terror weapon, the Polyphemus XBP shooter, has decimated the entire war fleet of Athens, and with God's help, we shall..."
"You know," Lindblom said meditatively from the tiny speaker of the Flapple's vidset, "you'd feel damn funny if one of Brose's people were monitoring this."
Below, a wide river like wet silver wiggled from north to south, and Joseph Adams leaned out to view the Mississippi and acknowledge its beauty. No recon crews had accomplished this. What glistened in the morning sun was an element of the old creation. The original world, which did not need to be recreated, reconned, because it had never departed. This sight, like that of the Pacific, always sobered him,
because it meant that something had proved stronger. Something had escaped.
"Let him monitor," Adam said, filled with vigor. He drew strength from the wavering silver line below, strength enough to ring off, cut the switch of the vid set, just in case Bros was monitoring. And then, beyond the Mississippi, he saw a man-made focus of upright, hard structures, and these, too, gave him a funny feeling. Because these were the Ozymandias Hoo-Hee Great Connapt dwellings erected by that busy builder, Lewis Runcible. That one-man ant army that, in its marches, did not gnaw down with its mandibles, but set up, with its many metal arms, one gigantic dorm-like structure, including kids' playgrounds, swimming pools, ping-pong tables, and dartboards. "Ye shall know the truth," Adams thought, "and by this thou shalt enslave." Or, as Yancey would put it, "My fellow Americans, I have before me a document so sacred and momentous that I'm going to ask you to..." And so on. Now he felt tired, and he had not even reached 580 Fifth Avenue, New York, in the agency, had not begun his day. Alone, at his domain on the Pacific, he felt the weedy, twisted fog of loneliness grow by day and by night and clog the passages of his throat. Here, in transit across the reconned and not yet, O Lord, but soon to be reconned areas, and of course the still hot spots which lay like ringworm circles every so often, he felt this uneasy shame. He glowed with guilt, not because recon was bad, but it was bad, and he knew who and what it was. "I wish there was one missile left," he said to himself, "in orbit, and we could touch one of those quaint old-time buttons the brass ones had at their disposal, and that missile would go pfoom at Geneva and Stanton Bros. By God," Adams thought, "maybe I will program the VAC one day, not with a speech, even a good speech like the one here beside me that I got off last night, finally, but the very simple, calm statement of what gives. I'll get through the VAC to the sim itself, then onto AUD and vid tape, because since that's autonomic, there's no editing, unless, of course, Eisenblut happens to stroll in, and even he technically can't touch the speech part of the reading matter. And then the sky will fall in." "But that ought to be interesting to watch," Adams mused, "if you could get far enough off to watch." "Listen," he would program to Megavac 6V, "and all those funny little dingbats that the VAC had in it would spin, and out of the sim's mouth would come the utterance, but transformed. The simple word would be given that fine, corroborative detail to supply verisimilitude to what was, let us face it," he thought caustically, "an otherwise incredibly bald and unconvincing narrative. What entered Megavac 6V as a mere logos would emerge for the TV lenses and mics to capture in the guise of a pronouncement, one which nobody in his right mind, especially if encapsulated subsurface for 15 years, would doubt. But it would be a paradox because Yancey himself would be pontificating it, like the old saw, 'Everything I say is a lie.' This would confound itself. Tie its skinny, slippery self into a good, hard sailor's knot. And what would be achieved? Since, after all, Geneva would pounce on it, and we are not amused," Joseph Adams articulated within his own mind the voice which he, like every other Yance man, had long ago interjected, the super-ego, as the pre-war intellectuals had called it, or, before that, the einbite of Inuit, or some such rustic medieval old phrase. Conscience. Stanton Bros, holed up in his castle-like Festung in Geneva like some pointed-hat alchemist, like a corrupted, decayed, but, as they say, shining and stinking, glowing pale white fish of the sea, a dead mackerel with clouded-over glaucoma-like eyes. Or did Bros look like this? Only twice in his life had he, Joseph Adams, actually seen Bros in the flesh. Bros was old. What was it, 82? And not lean. Not a stick, ribboned with the streamers of smoked, dried flesh.
Bros at 82 weighed a ton, waddled and rolled, pitched with his mouth drizzling and his nose as well. And yet the heart still beat. Because, of course, it was an Artiforg heart. And an Artiforg spleen, and an Artiforg, and so on. But yet, the authentic Bros remained. Because the brain was not Artiforg. There was no such thing. To manufacture an Artiforg brain, to have done so when that firm, Artigan Corporation of Phoenix, existed back before the war, would have been to go into what Adams liked to think of as the genuine simulated silver business, his term for what he considered, with its multiform-spawned offspring, the universe of authentic fakes. And that universe, he reflected, which you would think you could enter the indoor of, pass through, and then exit by the outdoor of in, say, roughly 2 minutes, that universe, like Eisenblut's prop heaps in the Moscow film studios, was endless, was room beyond room. The outdoor of one room was only the indoor for the next. And now, if Vern Lindblom were correct, if the man from the Private Intelligence Corporation, Webster Foote Limited of London, were correct, some new indoor had swung open, given momentum by the hand that reached in all its trembling senility from Geneva. In Adams's mind, the metaphor, growing, became visual and frightening. He actually experienced the doorway ahead, felt the darkness breathed by it. Room lacking light, into which he would soon tread, faced by God knew what task that was not a nightmare. Not like the black, listless fogs from within and without, formless, but too distinct. Spelled out in graphically unambiguous words in a memo originating from that damn monster pit, Geneva. General Holt, even Marshal Heronzany, who after all was a Red Army officer and not in any sense a bunthorn sniffing at a sunflower, even Heronzany sometimes listened. But the waddling, drizzling, eye-rolling old hulk chuck full of Artiforgs, Bros had greedily ingested Artiforg after Artiforg of the world's small and dwindling supply, was earless. Literally. Years ago, the organs of that sense had withered away, and Bros had declined Artiforg replacements. He liked not to hear. When Bros reviewed each and every TV tape of Yancey's speeches, he did not listen. Horribly, or so it seemed to Adams, the fat, semi-dead organism received the awed portion by direct wire, through electrodes grafted, skillfully implanted years ago, in the proper section of his elderly brain. In the one original organ, which was Bros, the rest now being Tin Woodman-wise, a mere procession of Artigan Corporation's plastic, complex, never-failing, they had, before the war, proudly carried lifetime guarantees, and in the Artiforg business, the meaning of the word lifetime, that is, whether it applied to the life of the object or of the owner, was delightfully clear. Replacements which lesser men, the Yance men as a whole, had a kind of nominal, formal claim on, in that, while still warehoused in the subsurface storage vaults under Estes Park, the Artiforg supplies belonged to the Yance men as a class and not merely to Bros. But it didn't quite work out that way, because when a kidney failed, as had occurred to Shelby Lane, whose domain up in Oregon Adams had frequently visited, there was no Artiforg kidney for Mr. Lane, although in the warehouse three were known to exist. It seemed, and for some reason, as he lay in his bed in the master bedroom of his domain, surrounded by his entourage of worrying leadies, Lane had not seemed convinced by the argument. Bros had put on these three Artiforg kidneys what legally was called an attachment. He had attached the goddamn organs, tied them up, stopped their use by a complex quasi-legal prior claim. Lane, pathetically, had taken it to the Recon Disin Council, which sat perpetually in session at Mexico City, passing judgment on the land boundary quarrels between domain owners, a council on which one leady of each type sat. Lane had not exactly lost, but he had quite certainly not won in that he was dead. He had died while waiting for the issue of attachment to be settled, and Bros lived on with the knowledge that he could suffer three more total kidney failures and survive. And anyone who chose to go before the Recon Disin Council would undoubtedly be dead, like Lane, and the litigation would, with the plaintiff, expire. The fat old louse, Adams thought, and he saw ahead New York City, the spires, the post-war high-rise buildings, the ramps and tunnels, the hovering fruit fly flapples which, like his own, carried Yance men to their offices to begin Monday. And, a moment later, he hovered fruit fly-like himself over the especially tall Cardinal Building, 580 Fifth Avenue, and the agency. The entire city was the agency, of course. The buildings on each side were as much a part of the machinery as this one Omphalos. But here his particular office lay. Here he entrenched himself against the competing members of his own class. It was a top job that he held, and in his briefcase, which he now picked up expectantly, lay, as he well knew, top-drawer material. Maybe Lindblom was right. Maybe the Russians were about to bomb Carthage. He reached the down-ramp of the roof field, touched the high-speed button, and dropped like a plumb line for his floor and office. When he entered his office, briefcase in hand, he utterly, without a shade or glimpse of warning, faced a mound of rubber, winking and blinking, flapping seal-like its pseudopodia and peeping at him while with its slit-like mouth it gaped and grinned, pleased at his dismay, pleased to horrify both by how it physically looked and who it was.
"Mr. Adams, a word with you, sir."
The thing, which had somehow managed to wedge itself into the chair at his desk, was Stanton Brose.